accession of 32747, Rule 3.
We were building the tunnels in Cranji Valley. We were told that the idea was that three men would build a tunnel 2 metres square, 20 metres in, 20 metres away another tunnel would be built. We would then turn left and right, build a bigger cavern in the centre. These places would be used by the Japanese to store food and ammunition, because they expected the Allies to invade, in Singapore in this case. On the tunnel that Jock, myself and another guy was working, we had a tall Japanese called Martin Anger. He was very considerate, he never lost his temper, and when we'd had a yasumi, following back on the next working day, he'd bring sweet potatoes, tapioca root, cigarettes. So we got on very well with him, and he could speak a little bit of English and Vicky Verky. When we were working in the tunnels, we worked by candlelight, and if we struck a rock face, we'd dynamite it, clear the rock out. On one occasion, in his English and Pidgin Jap, one man to guard the entrance, and he drew maps in the sand base, the ground. And he explained that the British were pushing the Japs out of Burma. This would be, I would think, about June, maybe about June 45. We knew nothing about this. He also said the Chinese communists were only 300 miles up country and they were going to push down. But, he said, you have a problem. The order from the Japanese High Command, as and when the Allies invade, whether it's Singapore, the Japanese island, all the prisoners were to be executed. Well, you've heard about that.
He told you that?
He told us that. And I always remember Jock, who'd got a very expressive vocabulary, being a Scot. I won't use the word, he said, what, after 3.5 years? And Martin Anger said, what you should do, break out of camp, once you're here, and get up in the hills in Singapore. And I remember saying, what hills? Because there are no bloody hills in Singapore, except the valley. At least it was food for thought. So we heard the first story about the first bomb. We were carrying on working. General Sato was living in Singapore. He was in charge of the whole of the South Pacific. So was it 2 or 3 days later, the same officer came in and said, apparently there's been another unusual bomb on Nagasaki. We don't know any more about that. And as you know, the stupid military government still refused until, so we told, the emperor stepped in and said on Japanese radio for the first time, the war is not going in the direction that we hoped, and we are there, we're compelled now to surrender. Now then, the General Sato in Singapore refused to acknowledge this. We actually carried on working, Meg, for another 10 days until they flew an envoy out from Japan with the Emperor's signature instructing Sato to accept surrender. And of course, by that time the Allies had dropped leaflets saying don't harm the prisoners, because they'd heard about this business of. And I also remember the memorable day, a little Jap came down into the valley, all men campo down till we thought this is it. We'd heard, we knew that the bombs had been dropped, but we were wondering what was going to happen. Was the war finished? And outside the working area, there was wagons to climb aboard, because normally we had to walk back to camp, or walk to it. And I also remember climbing aboard, and one of our guys started singing, I'm going home for Christmas. And even the Jap guards laughed. We got back to the prison camp, and round the wire, all the limmies, that's the guys with that have been wounded in action, limbs off it, cheering away there. So we knew it was over then. We went into camp. By that time, food had been delivered by the Japs, cigarettes, and I think, was it 2 days later? Gurkha paras dropped round the camp, and we went to the wire, said hello Johnny, we couldn't converse with them, and I'd got a packet of Japanese cigarettes. I offered a sergeant a cigarette. He took it off me and the packet, put it on the ground, put his foot in it and gave me a packet of players. Lovely. An unusual experience. We were hanging about waiting to, well, we didn't know what was happening because the Allies hadn't moved in. Our billet was the nearest to the entrance to the prison camp, and we were just lying about. We got cigarettes, and one of our guys said, there's a blonde lady walking across the padang, that's the parade ground. So somebody said, come inside, you silly buggy, you've been in the sun too long. He said, there's a blonde lady walking across the padang. Get covered up. Half our guy, we rushed out. Sure enough, a blonde lady, she was an Australian RAF officer. She'd been dropped by a parachute, and she came up, and we surrounded her, of course. And she explained that her husband, during the war, had been a squadron leader. She'd not heard from him, so she'd volunteered to come into Singapore and look after the RAF. She said, I'm going to get you guys into, well, the best hotel that's still standing, prior to going home. Well, we kept bending her ear for about, God knows. And then she said, I think I'd better make contact with your officers. So we had to let her go. That was unusual. Whether she ever found, I don't know. And then probably the only other point of interest while we were waiting, Jock, myself and another guy, who was a mechanic, we went under the wire, got a wagon from the Jap transport, drove into Singapore. This would be about a week after it was over. And coming towards us, three guys in white navy. We approached them and they said, like, where have you come from? We told them. Excuse me. Right, come with us. Back to Keppel Harbour. Climbed aboard the Nelson, HMS Nelson, the biggest ship in the British Navy. And what a time they gave us. Huh? Down in the petty officers' mess and so on. Of course, you know, probably these stories are in the book anyway. And they gave us, we had a shower, they gave us new clothes. While we were in the shower, they asked the cook in the kitchen, and they said, what would you guys like? We said, well, bacon and eggs. I can't imagine asking a prisoner of war. Well, ex-prisoner of war by then. Out came a plate, bacon, eggs and trimmings, hot, strong navy tea. It was magic, you know. And while we were there, or when we'd finished the meal, the ship's klaxons went and they had to go up on deck. They came back about 20, half an hour. They said, oh, we've just had a VIP. Mountbatten dropped in with his lady. He was doing a grand tour of the Pacific. And then about 10-ish, the ship's captain said, again through the tannoy, we've been very pleased to have you guys aboard, but I think it's time you went back to your camp. We wish you bon voyage, you know that. And they gave us kit bags full of tinned food, bread, butter, shaving gear, everything. So we thanked them, of course. Took us back on the Liberty boat, get it ashore. We went to our wagon and it wouldn't start. This would be 11 o'clockish. So we said, all right, we bed down for the night, have a look at it in the daylight. About an hour or so later, an army jeep pulled up. There's a driver and a lieutenant. He saw three guys sleeping near a big wagon. What are you doing here? So we explain where you come from. We told him, Cranji, climb in, went back. All our guys were asleep. We crept in very carefully. Next morning, guys waking up, and we started dishing out the food. And they said, like, where's it come from? Well, we said, Father Christmas must have come during the night. This is all true. It took a bit of convincing. I mean, there was kit bags full of butter, bread, everything that we'd never had.
Yeah.
And I said, we can have a proper shave now. So that was one of the nice sort of conclusions.
Did you have to be careful how you ate in those early days?
Yeah, we didn't know that, Meg, because we probably didn't even think about it. Because imagine baking an egg and after half a bowl of rice, it was a big difference. But to my knowledge, none of the three of us had any after effects.
Yeah.
But I know that on board the ship coming home, it was a proper balanced diet, you know.
Yeah.
Because I remember putting nearly 3 stone on.
Yeah.
It was incredible.
Do you know what your weight was when the war ended?
Yeah, I was about 7 stone, give or take a pound. Because I was never a big guy.
No.
But probably about 9.5 stone when I got off the boat. And my average weight was 10.5. I'm about 11 now, so it's never varied very much, you know. Mm. But I was, as I said, lucky. I was never ill from, what would it be? April, May 43, right through the rest of the war. I was never down with anything. Oh, I got toothache once. This was in Java, in Bandung, and there was no electricity, but there was a Dutch doctor who was also a dentist. And I went in his, whatever you'd call it. Oh, yeah, he said, I'll have to put a filling in. And he had a wheel with a foot pedal. And, of course, I felt it a bit. But whatever he did, he put something in, and it lasted till I got home anyway.
Fantastic.
And I remember the current dentist I go to, when I moved down here, I happened to mention it to him. Oh, he said, yeah, I've seen them in the museum.
Did you get any word from home while you were a prisoner?
Not a single word, no.
Did you send anything
out? Yeah. In fact, I'll show you this when we're finished. In the book, my love, one guy has written, I've read it, of course, the story about the plane that crashed. I've actually got a card, or my wife got, that was rescued. It's all damaged, but it was rescued. So she was one of the lucky ones that got the card. I'll show you after.
What ship did you return home on?
Oh, crikey. Names.
Don't worry.
It was a Dutch ship.
When did you leave Singapore?
It would... middle of September, 45,
mm-hmm.
Tegelberg, HMS, no, SS Tegelberg, it was a Dutch ship, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was guessing about mid-September, and we arrived back in Liverpool, Meg, to the same quayside that we'd left 4 years and 4 months before.
Did you have any welcome?
Oh, welcome.
Tell me.
Jock and I were up on the boat davits, you know, where the... And we saw crowds of people. And he couldn't recognise them from that distance. And we were smoking. And then Jock said, I'm sure I can hear your name. So we came down onto the promenade deck, which, you know, the level. And after focusing eyes, I could see my wife, mother and father, my sister, one of my wife's sisters, an aunt, and a cousin, a lady cousin. My dad, I could just see this, he went and spoke to a policeman. And I don't know how, why, what. He was allowed to leave the party and come alongside the ship. So I'm talking down to him, And I said, "Holy," he had a Trilby. I said, "Holy Trilby," and I'd got a kit bag full of 50 round tins of senior service that we bought on the ship. And I threw him two tins down. He caught me his cap. And then, of course, we were allowed off. And, well, you can imagine the greeting. I mean, I started with my wife. And then this young lady, Joan, she was a cousin. I hadn't seen her since she was 14. Well, young ladies grow up very quickly. And she's told me many times, because she's still living, she said, "You grabbed me," Sid, and said, "I don't know who you are, but you're very beautiful." I just didn't recognise her.
Yeah, indeed.
And of course, I think we were allowed half an hour with them, and then we went to Cosford, which was where the rehabilitation was, you know.
Right. How long did you spend in Cosford?
We were only in Cosford Thursday to Saturday, and then we got 6 weeks' leave. After the leave, of course, we had to go back to Cosford. Mm-hmm. And that would be in, just before Christmas, 45. And we had to wait for the mob because they couldn't get rid of us all at once. And I eventually left the Air Force in the first week in March, 46.
Did you have any idea what to go on to out of the Air Force? Did you have a job waiting for you?
Yeah. The job I left when I joined the Air Force was in the cotton trade. It was a firm making sheets and pillowcases where I met my wife. I was the designer, would you believe, of all the embroidery and fancy stuff. Just the boss and I and about 60 ladies, various ages. And that's where I met Hilda. I went back to see them when I was on leave. Because if you joined up voluntary, the firm you left didn't have to make up your pay. But if you were called up during the war, whatever the Army, Navy, Air Force paid you, if there was a difference, the firm you left had to make up the difference. So I got nothing off them. Not that it mattered, because I was only on about £2 a week anyway. I went and saw them, and some of the guys had been called up later on in the war. And I was called out of one of the director's offices. And he said, "Welcome back, Kurt White," said. He said, and he gave me an envelope. He said, "This is what you're going to do for us now you've come back." When I got outside his office, I opened it, and there's a fiver in it. About £1 a year while I'd been away. This is what I was going to do for him. So I went back, because my wife wasn't there then. She, when I'd left, she joined the Royal Ordnance Factory. Munitions, you know. And I stayed there, I think, about 3 weeks. I thought, there's no future. So I sat down, because my wife had got a house while I was away, and I wrote to the town clerk of Salford. I explained who I was. I said, "What have you got?" And I got a letter back. Would I make an appointment with the City of Salford Gas Department? And I got a job with them as a maintenance salesman. I stayed on that job maybe 3 or 4 years. I got a little bit ambitious. There was vacancies for showroom managers. I applied and got one of those. Stayed with the gas maybe till, what would it be, 1958, 59. I always remember it was the year of the United Air crash, you know. And I joined this London firm, who, as I said earlier, made gas-fired warm air for multi-storey blocks. Every big city was building these. So it was a good job, actually. And I was given the job as rep for the whole of the North West, which suited me fine. Mm. Liverpool, Manchester, North Wales. And I was doing that job. I became an area manager. Then Thorn took over. There's William Sugg by name. It was a very, very old Victorian company that had been in the job of making gas appliances. All the big lamps around Pall Mall and Buckingham Palace, originally gas, they were all made by this firm. And the factory was in was it Regency Street in Westminster, very, very old factory. Mm-hmm. And I remember going down for an interview in the boardroom, and the sales director, Mr. George Vernon, a very typical London aristocrat, right, said, no, Whitehead at first. He said, you'll be hearing from us. This was the first interview. They booked me in overnight. A week later, I got another appointment. I went down, and his secretary said, oh, Mr. Vernon's delayed. Well, just wait here. She gave me a magazine. About an hour later, he said, he's in now. I went in, and I could tell straight away he'd had a wet lunch. And he was a guy like this. he said, and he called me Sydney. I thought, strange, I've only met you once. Sydney, I don't think we're paying you enough. It's so daft, this, Meg, but it happened. I thought, is he talking to me? I didn't even know I got the job. He said, I've decided to increase your salary from £850 to £900 a year. I said, that's very kind of you, Mr. Vernon. I didn't say I didn't know I got the job. He said, you know the North West quite well. I said, yeah. You know where Wellman House is? I said, yeah. That was Gasboard HQ in Cheshire. He said, my secretary will write to you and confirm with you that I'll be driving a car up. You will meet me at Piccadilly Station, where I can park. Then you will drive me to Wellman House to meet all the gas chiefs, which I did. Came back, and he went back to London by train. He brought me a brand new Ford Consul, then the biggest car that Ford made. I all thought, this is it, yeah. And it did prove to be very, very good, you know. Mm. Progressively, then when Thorne took over, they bought Old Suggs out, and I was appointed national manager, mm-hmm. mainly because of the experience. I was allowed to get my own team together, and Thorne, as you can probably remember, or you might not, Sir Jules Thorne, he was an Austrian Jew, came to England, I don't know when, selling electrical components, mm-hmm. and he built the Thorne Empire. I met him actually, mm-hmm. little guy. Mm-hmm. We were doing a big exhibition in Olympia, and I was in charge, and he came with his binder, and this guy said, Mr. Whitehead, got a name badge, is anywhere Sir Jules can have his lunch? Well, we had a private place at the back. Out came, he was carrying a little attach gate, opened up, thermos flask, and a packet of brown bread sandwiches for Sir Jules. Incredible. And he said to me, he looked on my bag, said, Mr. Whitehead, when I've had my lunch, tell me what I've bought. He hadn't a bloody clue what. That was the situation. Funny, funny.
Sid, how you described very clearly your first months and years back home. Did you have any problems settling back? Did you have any hangovers from those days in captivity?
None at all, Meg. I've heard, as you know, lots of guys had nightmares. No, I had nothing at all. I was fit, as fit as could be. And of course I was so, how can I put it, over the moon. When my wife, I told her we arrived on the Thursday, we came home and leave on the Saturday. Hilda, my mother and dad, met me at Piccadilly Station with a taxi. I thought we were going back to the house where we'd been in what we call digs, where Hilda lived with these people. The taxi arrives in the street. There's a big banner across the street. Welcome. This is where I live. Welcome home, Sid. And got out of the car, and Hilda said, I'm going to show you something. She put a key in my hand. Went across to a number 26. Said, this is where we live. So, I don't think anybody could have had a more, you know, not just pleasant, but really miraculous. I mean, there I was, a lovely wife, a little home. There was a fire burning in the grate, and so on, you know.
Yeah.
It was just marvellous, you know.
Yeah.
And she then took me around, showing me off to friends, relations. I don't know about other guys, but I'd certainly never had any after effects at all.
How did you feel about the Japanese after the
Well, war? Initially, I didn't give very much thought to them. I mean, immediately. People asked me questions. Particularly my dad, he, being a First World War guy, he said, we've heard a lot about, you know. Well, I said, yeah, it wasn't exactly a holiday camp. I didn't pay it a lot of attention. I thought, the less I get involved, it happened, but turn that page over, you know. All I was concerned about, I've still got letters that never reached me before the Jap war started. Apparently, postal communication between the UK and Singapore finished in about November. No more mail got through. Hilda sent letters that were sent back to her, and of course she kept them for me when I came home. Yeah. And a quick one on mail. The ship, the Tegelberg, stopped at Gibraltar, for water and whatever. And Jock and I were sat on deck, knowing that we couldn't be very far from home. And a military, I don't know who he was, came aboard, shouting, "Mail for you lads," shouting by name. And I got 21 letters. Because Hilda, like all the wives that had been, said, "You can start writing once a week." And she must have put two or three in. And they're all addressed to HMS Tegelberg, Gibraltar. Got a stack of letters. Jock sat next to me, who never heard from anybody. Every letter I read, I passed over to him to let him read. I think that probably, getting back to what you said about camaraderie, just about summed it up, that, you know.
Indeed. Indeed.